The $100 million man is on our cover this week. Across Major League Baseball, the NBA, NFL, and NHL, we counted 203 of them. We'll talk about $100 million contracts and some trends we found behind them with our Brett McCormick. Then we'll have Adam Stern in to talk about a video game league that'll go from modeling spectator sport to actually trying to be one. And we'll close with executive editor and publisher Abe Madcor and what we're watching around sports. All that and whatever else comes up once we get talking here in the newsroom of Sports Business Journal. I'm Bill King, and this is First Look. $100 million. $1 million. We've almost become immune at this point to the $100 million contract across sports. You know, in baseball, we've eclipsed $200 million in total values, and now we're into the $300 millions. You think about the summer of Bryce Harper and Manny Machado. You think about the NBA deals that have rolled through in recent years. $100 million is almost at the lower end of the food chain. And yet when you start to really dig into the numbers and take a look at the growth and progression and some of the differences across sports, it does get interesting. Our Brett McCormick and Liz Mullen took a look at that very topic this week. It's our cover story, and Brett is in to join me. Brett, $100 million.
I was going to see how many times you can say that in the intro.
I'm working on it, dude.
Yeah. Now, this was Liz Mullen's idea. She covers agents, and I think one of them put this in her ear, and she passed it along to me. And it's one of those, like you said, it's one of those things that like we've gotten immune to, but there's no, like, there wasn't a good list of all the sports.
Right.
You know, baseball has been covered really well, but there wasn't a good list for the other three major sports. And you know, I was like pretty blown away by how many there were. I mean,
203
total. Yeah, and like you said, this year not only eclipsed 300 million, but 400 with Mike Trout. Baseball, for all the talk of struggles or whatever, you know, there's a couple of players that are not struggling. I mean, they had three of the biggest four contracts in pro sports history were signed this year,
and they're actually guaranteed, unlike the NFL.
Yeah, definitely. So there was a lot of differences in each league. Obviously, the numbers are different, but I would say our biggest takeaway is probably that, based on a couple of factors, which I'm sure we'll get into, the NBA is closing in on Major League Baseball, which for a long time really had cornered the market on $100 million contracts. NBA is definitely catching up, and even the NFL is starting to do a little bit better. It had such a late start based on its collective bargaining situation. But
the NFL is so tough to study, right? Because again, what is the deal? In so many cases, those deals get announced as a big number. I've always really felt like in a lot of cases it was almost abused. Well, it's hard to say anybody's being abused when they're getting an eight or nine figure deal. But with that said, I don't know that there was always a lot of transparency across the NFL, and so players would be told by their agents that they had this $100 million deal. Well, maybe 60 of it was guaranteed or 50 was guaranteed. And really, all that matters is what's guaranteed. The signing bonus, obviously. And those signing bonuses were there. Those were stout. But the lifetime value of those deals was not what they were told they would be.
Right. And so this has been the difference with, Major League Baseball. And NBA is catching up, I mean, because it's salary cap from 2014 to this year jumped from 63 to 109 million.
Right.
Teams had to spend 90% of their salary
cap.
So they had to spend the money, which I think is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's going to be an issue for the Major League Baseball.
Well, it is. And that whole bubble that was created there was I think scared a lot of people, because it made for what was not necessarily a real market. I mean, you saw players get money that, you know, nobody thought that they were worth, but the team had to, it was who's a guy who we can roll in here for just this much.
Yeah.
And whoever that happened to be got the money.
Well, then you have smaller rosters and they play.
Right. No, there's lots of reasons. Yeah. There's absolutely lots and lots and lots of reasons. And NBA players on the individual level have always done really well in that first seven slots. It's started to trickle down a little.
Yeah. For sure. Major League Baseball, no salary cap. You know, that's obviously why they set the trend, in this area. I mean, no contract lengths. I think if you look at like the NHL, they only had four of the five came in this one little, I would say, chunk of like 4 years.
Right.
And it was when they were signing, 10, 12, 13 year contracts, and they've stopped that. The limit now, I think, is either 7 or 8. So that's why you're not seeing many, if any, in NHL, the revenue probably not reaching.
Revenue's not there in the structure.
And 20 something players. So you got more guys you got to pay. But there were quite a few that were like close to the list. I mean, 80s and 90s. But
really?
Yeah, which surprised me. But you know, only Connor McDavid in 2017 is the most recent one. And then NFL, I mean, you just got, you know, there's a lot of factors with the NFL, but also like lack of longevity. I mean, they're just not going to give out contracts like that because guys just don't last that right. long. So if you think about it.
Oh, they'll give them to them. They just won't pay them.
Right. Well,
you can have. I mean, again.
But even still, they really don't give them out much. And you really need to be a quarterback. I think it was 26 out of 38 were quarterbacks. And so it's only changed recently that, you know, position guys are starting to get some of that money. But again, you know, you look at a roster that's got 53 people on it. I mean, that's, you know, it's hard to give such a huge chunk of money to one person. So, I mean, it's pretty easy to see why NFL, you know, has always been behind. But, you know, I would say they're catching up too. I mean, in the last 3 years, they've had 46% of their all-time 100 million deals were, you know,
in this last window,
in this last little 3 years. So they're making some moves, but you know, still a long way to go for them.
So you think about the NBA, you know, you've got something like, you know, where you've got a Supermax, for example, right? Which is a big bump for this small handful of players, which is generally a 10-year player, but to retain a guy is what, 7 to 9 years, right? How does that factor in the NBA with a Supermax that I think in a lot of ways it's like, okay, well, if you've made Supermax, you're going to be Supermax.
Yeah, I mean, they're getting to it quicker, right? I mean, because you don't have to do the duration that you did right. previously. So, I mean, I think this is another one of those. I think it's 2017 when they did that last CBA.
Right.
This was another one of those gains where, you know, you get to that deal faster. And so I think that like something to watch in the future would be how quick do you get to the money? So, mm-hmm. you know, because even the big baseball deals, again, those are decade plus deals, whereas the NBA, I mean, these guys are getting, you know, it's 5 years,
right?
200 million,
right? Well, that's
they're getting there so much faster.
Well, that's such a product of the, you know, that's such a product. Again, in the NBA, you've got the rookie contract, you know, so that's your first couple of years, and then you get your first decent hit after that, and then you roll into the contract where you really, really get paid. Baseball's so different because, in many ways, you know, some of these deals are not so much these, but maybe right below the cusp of $100 million is where you've got a player who, if they got to arbitration, they're probably going to get you for $15 or $20 million. But that's going to be in year four. And so you go to that player in year one or year two and you say, okay, we can give you, look at Atlanta, got a lot of criticism for what they did with their young players this year, going, doing just that, taking a guy who's making minimum or a little bit above, because there's no middle ground, right? If you're a first, second, third year player, you're at scale basically. So you buy out those years at a way, way, way lower rate than if you got to arbitration. That's one of the interesting things. You think about the $100 million deal. Who has gotten so many of those $100 million deals in baseball? Which agent?
Boris.
Scott Boris.
21.
Exactly. Yeah. 21. And nobody is close, correct?
Right. He's at least 11 or 12 ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And what distinguishes Scott Boris? Scott Boris takes his players to arbitration. Yeah. Scott Boris does not believe in those deals to buy out those early years. It very rarely happens. And so I think when you look at those two distinct philosophies, I think there's a definite connection. Now, as a player, is it hard to say I'll take the 300 or the 600,000, you know, depending on where we are in time? Am I going to be happy with that, or do I want the 5 million? Well, the 5 million is way less than I'll get in 4 years,
right?
But
it's right there.
It's going to make me a wealthy person right now, right?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great point.
So what else did you guys see when you looked at which agents get their guys paid? Did you see a real clustering or is it spread out?
It's pretty spread out, honestly. Boris like stands out by a lot.
Right.
NFL is really spread out. I think the most was, I'm going to say it was Tom Condon probably.
Right, right.
And then I think David
quarterbacks,
Dunn.
Quarterbacks again.
Yeah, exactly. And then David Dunn was right around there, which I think is a lot of quarterbacks. But yeah, NFL was really kind of spread out. NBA, Jeff Schwartz dominates, but after that, it's pretty spread out. Rich Paul has 5, I think, in the last like 4 years. So
right.
He's catching up. I think if we did this again in like 3 years, he would be in double digits for sure. There may be a few names that like
right.
you know, GMs would be like, oh God. But you know, I don't think there's, I mean, there's people in there that like they've done one, and that's still pretty amazing.
Right. Well, that's all you need when you're talking about. I get to say it again. 100 million.
Right.
100 million. $100 million.
Right.
Yeah, I'll say it one more time. $100 million. Brett McCormick, thanks so much. Great stuff.
No problem.
So if you were to develop a map for a startup league in a sport in North America, you'd have at least one franchise in New York. You might put two in LA. You'd want to be in Houston and Philly and Boston and Dallas and probably San Francisco, Toronto, DC, Atlanta. That'd be your startup map pretty much. That's what the Overwatch video game league's footprint looks like as it enters the third season of its existence, and the first in which it'll begin in earnest to transition to become a spectator sport. In to run that down with us is our Adam Stern, who has a look at Overwatch in our issue this week. Adam, the map looks like traditional sports. The product looks more like a media property. What does the business model look like as they transition into this idea of spectator sport?
Yeah, much like traditional sports, you know, they're trying to make money off of things that you would see, you know, in a stick and ball league. So, you know, they have media rights deals, they sell merchandise, but now what they're transitioning to is trying to make money off of ticket sales and other items at events. So the first 2 years of this league, as they kind of built up operations, they basically played all of their games in Blizzard Arena, which is in Burbank near LA. Now, the teams still had their identity. They still existed, but the teams weren't playing at home. So they basically let the teams kind of build up their operations over the first two seasons. In this past season that just ended in September, in their second season, they had three dry run events. They had one in Dallas, one in Atlanta, one in Los Angeles. But basically, they've been playing the first 2 years largely in LA. And so this next year is going to be a very important one. This will be the first year when they transition to this new model where teams will start hosting home events, all 20 teams in the league, which, oh, by the way, includes several teams in China, a team in Paris, a team in London, and a team in South Korea in Seoul. So it's a very complex league. It's a very complex operation they're trying to pull off. But yes, they're trying to, you know, do like traditional sports do and use the geolocation, use the home team model as a way to unlock value of as what they see as kind of the model to make esports very popular, make people passionate about it, give people a reason to root and tune in.
So a little background for people. Blizzard Arena, what is that? Where, you know, when you think about what it is that it what it looks like, what they've been playing in, how many seats, how's it designed, that sort of thing.
You know, Blizzard's kind of own arena that they have for esports events that kind of served as the home, again, to kind of, as they incubated this new league, it's, I don't know.
But when we say arena, I mean, we're talking more like a TV studio. I mean, we're, like, think about it like the old wrestling model before WWE started going into the big buildings. The weekly show was really kind of a TV studio, right?
Yes. I mean, these arenas we're talking about are, you know, in the hundreds of seats, maybe in the low thousands. So, you know, they're designed to be intimate. You know, obviously it's not to
They're designed to not have to sell many tickets either.
Well, it's not to anyone's advantage to have a cavernous kind of setting.
Right.
So
right.
You want to be able to fill it up.
Yes.
That looks good for TV.
Right.
As anyone could tell you in kind of the TV business, you know, having 2,000 people seated in an arena for 2,000 people looks okay. But when you have 2,000 people sitting in a place for 20,000, it looks bad.
Or 200 for 1,000.
You know, obviously, I think, you know, some of the venues they'll be playing at next year, you know, they're going to be 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 venue seats, somewhere in that range. So they're not starting off crazy. But remember, the league is only 2 years old. So let's see where they grow to in time. Right now, a lot of these teams are playing at pre-existing venues. So they haven't built their own venues yet. So let's see where the leagues are 5, 10 years from now. In some of these, you know, in the executives' eyes who are most bullish on this league, they feel like eventually they might get to a place where they're building their own venues. They might have 10, 15, 20,000 seats. But for right now, as the leagues kind of start off, they haven't gotten to that point.
Another backdrop, just again, sort of point of education. Shooter game, right? First person shooter game. That's what this is.
It's a little bit of a twist on it. You know, it's a little bit more complex than just straight shooting. It's a little bit more, you know, fantasy based. It's not like, for example, Call of Duty,
right,
which is another Activision Blizzard game, which is just a straight first person
right
shooter. But it definitely involves guns.
And so that's what it looks like. So they have to have what, two home stands, and they can have as many as five, right?
That's exactly right. So, you know, the schedule.
See, I read the story.
The schedule will kind of, you know, develop over the coming years. So you know, for example, we spoke with the commissioner, Pete Vlastelica, former Fox Sports executive, and he noted that, you know, the way it's going to look in 2020 may be a little bit different than how it looks in the coming years. So it's kind of the first year of this new model. In 2021, 2022, maybe they change it a little bit. But yes, for 2020, each team will host at least two.
So who are some of them that are sort of all in at this beginning, right? They're going to go out and say, hey, we can do five.
Dallas is one. And Dallas is one of the teams that hosted a homestand dry run this year. And it was seen as successful. They hosted 4,500 fans. They basically sold out the venue that they were at. And so they kind of feel like they're kind of a team that already is ready to take on more. You know, one of the interesting things about what we're seeing is that not all the teams are playing at one venue to start. And some of these teams have territories in multiple cities. So, for example, as we know in our story,
right,
Florida Mayhem, they're not tied to one city. They're the Florida Mayhem. They're going to hold one event at the University of Miami and a second event in Orlando.
In Orlando at Full Sail University.
Correct.
By the way. So, right. I mean, we're not, they're not going to be even at UCF, right? They're in a, it's going to be.
Yeah. I mean, Full Sail has an esports arena, which right. is, you know, the NBA has used it for the NBA 2K League.
Right.
So it's a good esports arena. But yes, these are several thousand seat arenas. They're not 20,000 seat, but some of them are doing it different ways. So, for example, the Vancouver Titans, who are owned by the Aquilini family, which also owns the right. Vancouver Canucks and NHL, they actually are going to play at the Canucks' arena, Rogers Arena. They're not going to necessarily sell all of the seats, you know, even put all the seats on sale. But that, you know, there are different approaches that are being taken. Some playing in more intimate venues, some playing in bigger venues because of their ownership. So, you know, the league is letting teams kind of have some leeway here about how they want to approach it.
And there is a little bit for some of them, there's more of a festival feel, right? And which is interesting because when we say homestand, this is generally going to be you're going to buy a ticket and you're going to have access for 2 days, right? And so you're going to come, you're going to go. How's that going to play out? And how can that vary based on what maybe what else the team decides to build around the event?
Yeah, you know, teams are definitely trying to approach this just like we're seeing throughout sports. You know, people are kind of realizing that you can't just hold a game. You can't just hold, you know, teams playing. You need to hold it.
Especially when sitting there. Pressing buttons is what the activity is.
Yeah, you got to hold a wider an event. You got to bring in music. You got to bring in all sorts of different activities for people to do, even potentially on top of your corporate activation. So, you know, for example, we spoke to San Francisco Shock. They're planning to have like a carnival atmosphere with music, with arts. They're going to bring in like anime, which is, of course, big in the esports world, you know, anime designers, things like that for their event. We did not speak with Dallas, but our sister publication, the Esports Observer, did the Dallas Fuel. And they said they're going to be hosting like high school events and collegiate esports events as kind of sidebars to their main event to, as ways to kind of drum up, you know, action and activity. So there's all sorts of different ways that teams are going to be going about this to kind of make it more than just the teams playing from the Overwatch League. Because again, yes, you're right. These are going to be 2 day events as far as the homestands, and they want to make it into more than just the teams playing. So you're going to have the corporate sponsors. You're going to have all sorts of different displays, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, kind of who's able to activate the best, who ends up having kind of some of the more exciting displays. Because these teams are going about it differently.
And speaking of going about it differently, there is a healthy dose of skepticism, right, even in the video gaming world about whether this is the model. Like even if there is a spectator model for esports, or even if there is something beyond a media model for video games, I think a lot of people are skeptical about this one, right? The idea that you will sell tickets. Is that the conversation right now?
Well, I think there is a conversation about, you know, there's a conversation in esports about whether franchising is the right way and you know, should leagues franchise or not. And then secondarily to that, there's a conversation about if you do franchise, is the right way to go about it geolocating or not. You know, kind of one of the other major esports is Riot Games' League of Legends.
Right.
And their North American League does sell franchises, but they're not tied to a certain city. And, you know, the Call of Duty League, which is starting up next year, as far as the franchise version, Call of Duty has a long esports history, and they're just now moving to this franchise model. And some of their longtime teams in their previous iterations of esports did not ultimately end up buying a franchise because they felt like it was too expensive or one thing or the other for this new league. And so that's potentially leaving out, you know, some of their, you know, longtime historic teams. And some of those teams who did not buy a franchise, who previously were involved in Call of Duty Esports, said one of the reasons why is they didn't like the geolocation model. They want to have fans all over the country. So there is that kind of discussion and debate going on. Some people feel like, hey, look, if you develop a brand, you know, an esports team brand in a certain way that stands for certain things, it might appeal to people all over the country. It might appeal to people all over the world. So you don't want to just constrain yourself just mm-hmm. to one city. The other school of thought, which is what Activision Blizzard is doing, right. is that there's value to be unlocked by giving people a local fan base to root for.
So if you think about where NBA 2K is now on this front and where it could be going forward, and then very differently where NASCAR is on this front and where it could be going forward, because NASCAR is like purely a media property in this regard, right? 2K, what are they talking about in terms of where it can go? Where are they in terms of being a spectator property?
I think stick and ball esports still has a ways to go. You know, I think one of the things that I found interesting covering esports is that it seems like the most successful esports all involve a little bit of an element of fantasy. You know, they're not right. things that happen in real life. You know, now that being said, there are popular video games that, of course, that are stick and ball based. So, you know, FIFA, Madden, NBA 2K, those are popular.
But the NBA 2K, and this is what, again, a lot of people listening to this podcast probably don't even realize this because I didn't realize it initially. But, you know, you think about NBA 2K, you're not playing, you know, with LeBron on the LA franchise, right? The player that is actually playing, the video game player, is playing as a character himself without NBA players. It's a big, big distinction between when you think about what somebody might be interested in if they're an NBA 2K player, right?
And that can vary from game to game. I think that is correct as far as NBA 2K.
Right.
But overall, for stick and ball esports, they're just not getting the viewership right now right. that you're seeing for the biggest traditional esports, League of Legends, Fortnite.
Right.
Even Rocket League, which is kind of right. this spin off of soccer and cars yeah. driving, you know, again, it has that kind of fantasy yeah. element. And so I think, you know, obviously it's very important for traditional sports to try and get involved in esports. There's no reason not to. But I think that they're finding that it's going to take some time to build this up and see if this can ultimately be a long term profitable venture, exciting venture, et cetera. I think it's too early for any league, NBA or otherwise, to call it a failure by any stretch. But whether it turns into becoming as big as some of these other traditional esports, the jury is absolutely still out if you look at the viewership numbers. And then attendance-wise and events, you know, it's tough to say for me. I haven't spent too much time looking into the NBA 2K League's attendance yet, but I know they've had some good events. So, you know, I don't think they have, you know, every single event in person. But as far as some of their championships events like that, they've had events at Full Sail University and brought out some decent crowds. So I think it can be a decent spectator sport. But again, whether they get the viewership that some of these traditional esports get, which is into the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands at one time routinely, that's the jury's still out on that because these esports properties from the stick and ball worlds just aren't drawing those numbers yet.
Well, this is going to be interesting to watch because again, this is we've talked about all these sports properties sort of flirting around here, and particularly you know even beyond what the leagues are doing, but you think about Overwatch and you think about some of the ownership groups in these areas with that they are traditional sports owners who see the world as here's media, here's ticket sales, here's sponsorships, here's this. That is very much the model that they're applying here. And for the first time, we're going to see maybe whether there's any life to it at all.
That's exactly right. And that's part of the way that Activision Blizzard was able to get so many investors from the traditional sports world. They made it look like traditional sports. And that's not necessarily pulling the wool over their eyes. That's a way to make it appealing to them and say, hey,
that's
look.
Why they called it esports and not video game leagues.
Well, but that's a way for them to show like, hey, look, you can use your skills that you already have from traditional sports, running traditional sports
right.
teams and make that transferable to esports. And so that's the hope is that, you know, not only can they unlock value in geolocating, but by making it appealing to these sports investors, these sports investors who are so sophisticated can help make the league better overall by bringing their expertise to the fore.
Well, it'll be an interesting one to continue to watch. Adam Stern, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now, as we typically do to close First Look, I'm going to bring in our executive editor and publisher, Abe Madcor, to talk about what we're watching around the sports business. Abe, what do you got?
Boy, I've been gone a couple of weeks with you not doing this, and a lot has happened.
It sure has.
Specifically in the NBA, and I know you and Ben Fisher talked a little bit about that a couple of weeks
right.
ago. But boy, that could be a running discussion. So I can't
it ain't going
say,
away.
I can't say that I'm taking my eye off that issue. at all, because today's Friday when we're recording this. And obviously on Friday, the Chinese government basically rebuked Adam Silver, saying that they never asked for him to fire Daryl Morey, which he said at a Time event on Thursday in New York. So I think this story has legs. And he already said, Adam Silver did, that they had seen significant financial implications from the last 2 weeks. Like I said, a source I talked to in the basketball world and the NBA world said, you know, Abe, this isn't about $1 billion. This is about billions of dollars that we could lose here. So I would implore all of the listeners of First Look to keep an eye and closely watch this fascinating geopolitical story that's going to continue for the next, for who knows
how long. Oh, by the way, which actually takes another turn, as because guess what? The season's about to open. And that's going to change everything, because all of a sudden the spotlight is going to come back onto it. People are going to start getting asked questions again. It's going to come up again. Yep. And anytime that's the case, I think that we could see this story take yet another turn.
And when will Daryl Morey go public? And that's a very interesting thing. No one's been able to really see him. He hasn't been out at all. And I think he will be a next storyline to keep an eye on. A couple of other things, Bill. These are quick. But last week, when Congress said that they are going to go after name, image, and likeness in the collegiate world, I thought that was a very important step here, that this issue is going to get significant traction. I don't love politicians. I don't like political grandstanding. But no doubt about it, when politicians get involved, things happen and there's reaction to that. And when Mitt Romney said, basically, we're coming after you, that was a pretty strong threat to me that they're going to take a close look at name, image, and likeness. So that's a story I can continue to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I think that certainly is going to keep it on the front burner of in terms of interest. Whether it gets to the front burner in the political process, I'm a little more skeptical about. I mean, look at what we saw, and Mitt's involved in the most recent one with sports betting. I mean, it's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to try and actually get any movement on it, get any legislation. I don't think we're even close to that. So, but with that said, look, anytime – if you're the NCAA, anytime that Congress gets interested in something, it certainly catches your attention.
Baseball. What am I watching in baseball? A couple things. I'm watching these owners who are overruling their general manager about managerial decisions. We saw John Middleton get very, very involved in the firing of Gabe Kapler. We saw Artie Moreno reportedly get very involved in the hiring, well, the firing of Brad Asmus and then the hiring of Joe Maddon. Both times, both owners seemingly going against they're Moneyball type general managers. Right. So is this a trend? Are we going to see some of these, you know, owners take a little bit more active role? And does this mean that these young general managers are really on a short leash and they have to win or else they're gone?
So Philly and Anaheim to me are a little bit different. You know, in the case of Anaheim, I think that's already seeing an opportunity to bring in a big name. Okay. So I think that's a business decision. I don't think that's even just a baseball decision. That's one where the general manager is maybe over here. Because he thinks, look, we've got something. This is how we work. This is how we do it. And I want to stick with my guy. I don't fire a guy who I think is doing what we want him to do. And then you've got Artie on the other side saying, wait a minute. Joe Maddon's available now. Joe Maddon may not be available next year. Joe Maddon probably won't be available in a month. So if I want to, you know, polish up this franchise a little bit and show that I made a move, this is a good opportunity. So I think that's one thing. I think the other one is much more an owner probably hearing over and over again, what is this guy doing? And while what that guy was doing may have been in line with what the general manager wanted him to do, it probably was not. I think that there were plenty of head scratchers, you know, around Gabe Kapler over his entire tenure there. You know, for an owner who's engaged, you know, he hears that enough times and maybe he wants to make a move. And I think that was. So that's a little different.
He's
from Marty.
All right.
He is super engaged.
September listening tour of his players. You wonder if that's the best use of an owner, but he is the owner.
Exactly.
I'll just say that Artie Moreno's decision comes at a tough week for that organization because the fallout from the death of Tyler Skaggs is disappointing. It's sad. It's discouraging to know that this was going on within the organization.
Yes.
And if I'm Artie Moreno, I'm really taking a very deep dive into what went down here for a member of the PR department to be an enabler here. It's a very, very difficult story.
In baseball, where everyone lives together every day from late February through the end of September, it's hard for things to happen without people having some sort of an inkling. And I think that is going to come up again and again and again as people dig in more deeply to this. You know, I used to say it about the NFL and drug testing. NFL teams know what somebody is doing every hour of the day in the off season. You can't tell me that, you know, that they don't know this or that, or again, not just even steroid and HGH, you know, when there were some issues of guys getting in trouble. You know, you can't tell me that you know exactly what a guy weighs on Tuesday in the off season, but you don't know where he is on Tuesday night. That doesn't add up to me. So I think that's one of those things when you look at baseball culture. If you understand baseball and you understand the duration of a season and you understand everybody being on top of each other, you know, probably more people knew what was going on than we know so far.
Finally, on baseball, who will the Red Sox hire to run their baseball operations? I think they wanted Andrew Friedman. He eventually did stay with the Dodgers. So that is a very high-profile position, so I'm keeping an eye on that. A couple of other quick hitters. Formula One comes back to the United States this week, as you know, Bill. Bill will be in Austin. I think it's going to be interesting to watch the future of that race while we hear that Miami actually could be moving closer to landing an F1 race. And we know for a fact that F1 wants to be in Vegas. So if I'm a first look listener, I'm probably seeing how F1 operates this week in Austin. And then can the Dolphins and Tom Garfinkel and Stephen Ross land a deal in Miami? Or does F1 go to Vegas, or maybe both? Finally,
everything's going to Vegas. I was just there. Everything's going to Vegas.
Why do you think? It's a hot city. I've been saying that for a while. I'm with you, Bill. And then late last week, NASCAR and ISC closed their merger. Now I'm looking to see, as NASCAR takes over ISC, who leaves. There are going to be a lot of redundancies, and there's going to be a lot of positions that don't need such redundancies. So I do think you're going to see some people leave both of those organizations. Always kind of an uncomfortable time during a merger.
But inevitable. It's the reason, frequently the reason behind a merger.
And finally, I got to give a hat tip to a local resident here, Bill, in Charlotte, Michael Jordan. A great week for him late last week with his donation of nearly $8 million for two Novant health clinics, one in Charlotte, one outside of Charlotte. And he was very public in that donation. Then he went and spoke on the Today Show with, I thought, a pretty open interview where he talked about, hey, players should be getting something, but he acknowledged how difficult and complicated it was. He also said that if he had to do it all over again, he wouldn't have been more politically outspoken, and he wouldn't be more socially aware, not socially aware, but socially outspoken in issues. He said, I was focused on basketball and I wouldn't do it any different. And he had a very good answer of why he's able to kind of be more articulate now. He says he feels more informed and he's closer to some of these issues and he's read up on them. He feels more comfortable speaking on them. But I thought Michael Jordan, as he ages, Bill, I think he becomes a very interesting owner to watch and an interesting figure to watch because, I mean, he was in our generation. Like for
That's
us,
right.
He was the man.
And speaking of generation, that I think is really one of the differences between Michael and the players of today. That stick to sports mentality, that's not playing with players who are under 30. And it's not going to. It doesn't play with that generation.
With LeBron after the week he had 2 weeks ago.
He might learn from it. But with that said, you know, I don't think that, look, at you, when you hear it over and over and over again and people talk about what it's going to take and where you have to be on that moving forward as you look not only at millennials but Gen Z and their expectations of a brand to take a stance or hold a position and not be stuck in the middle or be about nothing or be silent. If that's all true, these players, we forget sometimes, those same people we talk about as consumers, that these guys are in that, you know, these guys are of that same mindset. And so I don't see that changing.
I don't know. I think that you'd be surprised how many times players are asked to, told to, and actually want to just say nothing. So we'll see. I know you're going to dig deep into this and the political issues as we continue to go forward in the political season. Finally, Michael Smith and I are going to be at the University of Kentucky next Friday and Saturday. We will present our award that we presented to Mitch Barnhart for Athletic Director of the Year. We presented that to him at our gala in New York in May, but we're doing a public presentation during the football game next Saturday night. So my first time at Lexington to the University of Kentucky. So if anybody, I'm looking forward to that. If anybody's going to that game, any first look listeners, let us know. We'd love to say hi. So that's what I'm watching, Bill.
All right, Abe, thanks so much. That's going to do it for this week. For Abe Madcore, Brett McCormick, Adam Stern, and our producer, Chris Mason, I'm Bill King, and this has been First Look.